No good.
Okay, everyone. I want to thank you for attending our sixth conference call, actually, that we've had in the past 35 days. We are very fortunate to have with us Dr. Nassef, who is a psychologist and independent practice owner in Philadelphia. And he is a consultant to numerous schools and human service organizations. And he has a broad background of experience in both education and psychology. He is a native Philadelphian, go Eagles, and a graduate of Temple University. And he serves on the board of director of the Center for Autistic Children, Special Children, Challenged Parents, The Struggles and Rewards of Parenting a Child with Disability was his first book. And he received local and national recognition. He's also been heard on national public radio. And one of the questions that we would get from many of you as we had our conference calls is, can we get some people here to talk to us about how autism affects relationships? Now, the statistics kind of, you know, vary, but the consensus seems to be that over 80% of marriages who have children with autism typically go through a divorce. And that's a very stark statistic, and I think that what many of you have asked for is, can we talk to somebody that can help us with strategies that we can use to help better, to strengthen our relationships with our families? And so that's why we brought here Dr. Robert Nassef, if I'm pronouncing it correctly here.
Nassef,
and, Nassef, okay, Nassef.
Right.
Okay. And he, we're lucky to have him today, and he's going to give us a talk about autism and relationships and families. And maybe you can start off by talking about your book. I think people would be very interested in picking up a copy of that.
Okay. Well, hi, everyone. I wrote a book about family life that's based somewhat on my experiences as the parent of a child with autism. He's 29 this fall. It's based on my experiences both as a parent and as a psychologist. It's called Special Children Challenge Parents, The Struggles and Rewards of Parenting a Child, Raising a Child with a Disability. And that focuses on a broad range of conditions, but autism being one of them. I've also co-edited a book called Voices from the Spectrum, which is a collection of 60 essays about autism written by parents, grandparents, teachers, doctors, people with autism, brothers and sisters of kids with autism. So a really broad range of viewpoints, voices from the spectrum. So you can go to Amazon.com, put in my name, Robert Nassef, N-A-S-E-E-F, and my books will come up. I also have a website that's called AlternativeChoices.com, and on my website there's various articles. And if you go to the page on the website that's called Special Families, you can sign up for my newsletter, which comes out roughly monthly, and I write articles about autism and other disabilities, how they impact families, what people can do to cope, and I answer people's questions and that sort of thing. So if you're interested, if tonight's discussion is something that you'd like to continue, the newsletter is a way that I keep in touch with people and keep bringing information and resources about family life to people. So, as I mentioned, I have an adult child with autism, so I've been living the life you've been living for almost longer than I can remember. Sometimes it seems like yesterday, and sometimes it seems like a lifetime ago. So tonight, especially based on what Ernest was saying, we're going to talk about how autism impacts the marriage and the family as a whole. And Ernest started by giving this oft-quoted statistic of 80% of an 80% divorce rate. Now, there's something kind of interesting going on in the world around us. Recently, I went on Google and I put autism in, and because I know people are just flooded with information and often can't get off the internet and can't make heads or tails of it. And 26 million web pages come up when you put the word autism in. So, you know, where do you start? Hard to know, and hard to know what information is reliable. There's a lot of myths out there on various topics, autism included. So then I went to Amazon and I thought, well, anybody can make a web page, but not anybody can write a book. So I put autism in the Amazon search engine, 17,000 books came up. Again, where do you start? I think, you know, we need people with expertise, people we can rely on and trust in our communities, in our schools, that we can turn to help us sort things out. In my work as a psychologist, I try to provide that for people. I see myself somewhat as an interpreter between the parent world and the professional world because I live in both. This statistic, and I'll just start with this since Ernest brought it up, of the 80% divorce rate is one of the myths. It's one of the myths. However, you go on the internet and it's on many, many websites, but however, there is no source for the statistic. There's never been any research that confirms this. But what is true? The divorce rate in our country is 50% for first marriages. And that's startling enough. It appears that the divorce rate for families of kids with autism and other disabilities is roughly the same. From studies that have been done over the years, they're generally inconclusive and generally don't find a higher divorce rate, and certainly nothing convincing, particularly with autism. We certainly need more research in this, but I just would want to disabuse you of that notion that 80% of your marriages are going to end in divorce. At least half will, and I myself have been divorced and remarried, and many people I know have been divorced and remarried. There's a lot of great step-parents in the autism community as well, as there is in society as a whole. But what is true? It is true that families raising kids with autism are under incredible stress, that their stress rates are higher than the general population. That's true. And sometimes that's the last straw for folks. And yes, if you're in a minority group, if you're economically disadvantaged, that just makes it all the much harder. Racism, poverty, single-parent families, it makes it just that much harder. But we don't need to so much walk in fear that 80% of us are going to go through a divorce. But people, I think what it reflects, though, is that people are under stress and worried about breaking up. So about 50% of first marriages fail, and interestingly, about 70% of second marriages end in divorce. And the main reason given for that is that in second marriages, we're often talking about step families, both people or one or the other bringing in kids from a previous marriage, and that's more complicated. And you know, to balance being a step parent and being a biological parent. And so second marriages have a much higher divorce rate than first marriages. If you take all marriages together, first, second, third, about 57% end in divorce. And as I said, there's more reported marital distress among families of children with special needs, autism included. There's high rates of depression amongst moms of kids with autism. I would think that's true of dads, but there's no studies on that that I can find at the moment. So why does the myth exist? I think because people want to have a reason for how bad they feel or how afraid they are, and maybe want to say autism is so awful, our families are breaking up, and maybe this, you know, provides, you know, some basis for getting support. But exaggerating the negative doesn't help us cope. It's hard enough. So what I want to hopefully do tonight is help folks get a grip on what can help your relationship and what positive is going on in your life and how you can build on that, how you can build on that. So that's my introduction, and maybe we can just get into some questions and discussion. I don't want to talk too long and miss talking about what's most important to you.
Okay. I have a question, and that is people, as you mentioned, were under stress and there's just so much going on with these families. How do parents cope? I mean, what if you said, if you had a list of, say, five things that parents could sort of use to cope, what would those five things be?
Okay, I actually
let's say I'm a husband, I'm a wife, and I'm a child, and you know, if there were five things that we could do to really help us cope, what would they be? I mean, I guess it varies for everyone, but
well, it does. Guess, but I mean, there's definitely things I could recommend. People that are satisfied with their marriages, that, you know, are happy with their spouses, they generally consider each other best friends. And friends enjoy doing things together. Mm-hmm. When autism enters the picture, people often, and understandably, get obsessed with the autism and obsessed or are out of balance in terms of the family as a whole and the relationship. So one of the best things you can do is finding some time to spend with your spouse, doing things you enjoy together. And it's, of course, this could be hard to do. It could be hard to get a babysitter, hard to go out for an evening. So I urge people to just start wherever you can. Figure out where you can steal some time for each other. It could be an in-home date, watching a video after the kids are in bed, or just sharing a glass of wine or a cup of tea. But find time to spend with each other. Take a walk around the block after the kids leave on the school bus, or whenever you can. See when you can spend a little time with each other. It doesn't have to be a formal date, although it could be. That would be number one, spend some time together. And think about taking care of yourself a little bit. The strain of this is tremendous. And actually, men are better at taking a break than women. And I guess if a lot of women are listening, you know this. Guys will take a break. They'll go out and play golf, or they'll go to a football game, right, or, you know, they will take a break. And moms have a harder time doing that. But if you can get a break, whether that's a little exercise after the kids are leave for school, or some journaling, or a few minutes reading the paper, just some time to relax. And almost any form of exercise will help. And especially if you could do it together, taking a walk, riding a bike. And, you know, when, especially with autism, you know, we learn a lot about behavior modification and reinforcing the positive. One of the best things couples can do, and all couples, not just parents of kids with autism, is let your partner know what they're doing right. It's hard to talk about.
I like the way you said that. Say that again.
Catch your partner doing something right.
Exactly.
Remember why you're together. People are together because they enjoyed each other. They had common interests. Catch your partner doing something right. This is the best help of all in just renewing your relationship and coping, you know, with the many, you know, things that we have to face.
Right.
I think that's about three or four. I can give some more.
But. Yeah, I think you got three. I think it was take a break, catch a partner doing something right, and then the other one was, let's see here, do something.
Find some
together.
Time for each other.
Yeah, find time for each other.
Do you want a few more?
Oh, no, that's fine. Those are good topics. And I know one of the questions that that I received earlier, too, was about, you know, sort of the dynamic. You may have one child that has autism and then the other children might not, and sort of how that dynamic creates stress on the mom, because she's now sort of, the other kids are asking, you know, why is she spending more time with the child who has autism and not as much with them? And I know that question has come up several times in our previous conference calls.
Mm-hmm.
I thought maybe you could discuss that too, because it does
sure.
seem to happen quite a bit.
Sure. I mean, that's a big part of what goes on in families. And if we just kind of step back from the issue just for a moment, it's really impossible to give equal time to children of various ages and abilities and interests. But what, and that's in any family. the youngest is usually and appropriately getting more attention. The child with autism, even if they're chronologically the oldest, is often developmentally younger. So that child is, in effect, going to hog the parents' attention. In fact, one of my daughters wrote an essay that's in the Voices from the Spectrum book where she called my son Dad Hogger. And, you know, when I quote from this essay at lectures and presentations I give, people always crack up because it kind of, from a kid's point of view, says it all. The kid with autism's hogging the attention of the parent. Why? Because that kid might not know danger, because that kid might not be able to verbalize well, because that kid has numerous problems, and it's totally necessary. But what is possible is to give each child some special attention and to meet their needs as best as possible. And again, there's some tips or coping strategies I could give you on this. It's really great to have a play date regularly with your typically developing child. It is also great to talk about what's going on, get children's books on autism. There's a lot of them now. But talk about it openly. Be able to listen to your kid's grievances about it and give them some special attention, whatever that might be. That goes a long way toward helping to have balance in the family and avoiding problems that might come up. If the typically developing sibling feels left out and doesn't seem to have a voice, that child may develop a symptom because that's the only way to get attention. So we want to avoid that by giving each child some special attention and explaining, you know, well, let's say the child with autism is Billy, that Billy's brain is different. Billy needs to go to speech therapy. Billy needs a special class, et cetera, et cetera. But you have needs too, and we're going to make sure those needs get met. And just that sort of special outlook on each child can bring about a very different dynamic as opposed to that child always has to wait and there's just not enough to go around.
Right. Well, very good. That's that will certainly help a lot of people here who've heard that because that is a very prevalent problem. And, you know, I get that question all the time, and I'm glad you answered it. So let's see here. For those of you that are on the call, please post some questions. We have our doctor here to answer our questions, and we definitely want you to post some more as time goes on here. There's some great information, I'm sure. And also, as we mentioned before, you may have heard before, we wanted to know how many of you, I believe, had children below the age of 3, was it?
Right. Birth to 3.
Okay, below the age of 3. And the other one was how many had them, say, between what other ages?
Elementary school, middle school, high school, those groups.
Okay, elementary school, mid school, and high school. Okay, good. So those of you, if you're listening online, just post that information so we can see it, so we kind of get an idea of who's in the room with us here. And let's see here. Here we have one question here from Angie from... I think from prior, I'm not sure what state that is, but the question is how do you help your other children understand autism and, in my case, OCD? My oldest is 14 and has ADHD, and my son is 4 and has autism, OCD, and many other problems.
Okay. How do you help children understand autism and maybe OCD and other things? I think it's sort of like helping children understand sex. By that I mean we need to give them information at their level. We need to answer questions that come up, explain differences, sort of keep it simple. Children who grow up well-adjusted, whether they have autism, whether they have OCD, or whether they're the typical siblings, they are better adjusted when they just We're always given information. We're always informed of what was going on. So as I mentioned a little while ago, there's a lot of good kids' books about autism. Andy's Yellow Frisbee, Russell's Extra Special. You know, go to Amazon, put in
Andy's Yellow Frisbee.
Russell's Extra Special are a couple, but there's a growing number. So, and public libraries have them, and schools have them. There didn't used to be much of this, but there's a decent supply of kids' books. And another one I really love is called All Cats Have Asperger's Syndrome. And that book uses the behavior of cats to help children and adults understand behavior in autism. So if you think of a cat and how they come to you when they want to and prefer to be alone a lot of the time. And it's a beautifully illustrated book from Jessica Kingsley Publishers in the United Kingdom. And it's also a book, it's a coffee table type book with a lot of, you know, really cute color pictures of cats. But it's actually a good book to help adults understand autism. I have one grandmom in my practice raising her grandson with autism, and she bought 10 copies and gave them to all her relatives. She had been giving them, like, magazine articles and journal articles and stuff from the school, and I don't know if they were reading it, but they certainly weren't getting it. But she then, when she saw this book in my office, All Cats Have Asperger's, she got that, and people seem to understand it and click in. One dad I counseled recently was perplexed about should he tell his son, who has high-functioning autism, that he has it. And the little boy was asking a lot of questions, like, why do I have a special aid in school, and why am I, you know, why do I have to do this, and why do I have to go to occupational therapy? And I said, sure, tell him. And he was nervous to tell him. But he saw this book in my office, and he got himself a copy of the Cats, All Cats Have Asperger's, and he left it laying around at home. And his son came to him one night and said, Dad, I read that book, and I think I have Asperger's. So kids really can pick up on this. The key is talking to them at their level, giving them information they can digest and that's sensible to them. Same thing with OCD. There's some kids' books about that. I don't have the titles on the top of my head. But again, they're pretty readily available. Just go to Amazon, put in children's books about obsessive compulsive disorder. You'll get a couple titles. You won't get 100 titles. You'll get 3 or 4 titles. And your library may have them. Often, OCD occurs simultaneously with autism, so, you know, you're not alone in that situation.
Sure.
So, hopefully I've covered that question. I don't want to go on too long.
Yeah, I think you did. That's, matter of fact, we've got a couple more here that have come in. We have one comment from a woman named Catherine who says, I love hearing the All Cats Have Asperger's because I've often said my son is a perfectly good cat, not a defective dog, because people on the spectrum are so cat-like. So
that's great.
Glad that you mentioned that.
Right. It's actually not a unique concept. It's been around for a while, and I have a friend who has Asperger's who, like, loves my cats and says, you know, I'm a cat. It's an interesting and creative and insightful way to understand it. Right. Our kids are not defective dogs.
Right.
And a lot of dogs have ADD, by the way. A lot of dogs have ADD.
That's correct. Yeah, I had a couple of golden retrievers that way.
Especially when they were young, right?
Yes, definitely. I have a question here from Debbie from Georgia, and her question is, do you have a suggestion for parents who don't agree on the course of treatment for a special needs child? If one parent checks out, the other ends up doing everything. How do we even out without creating friction?
Well, it's a little hard for me to answer, you know, in a general way.
Okay. I mean, that's got to come up because I know that some one person may say, you know what, as a matter of fact, we have one person here who even asked, you know, hey, I've shown them the diagnosis and they're still not on the same page with me. And that's got to be a struggle for people.
Oh, yeah. But let me give you some, I think I can talk about it in a general way.
Okay, good.
People, moms and dads, men and women, are still different individuals and not necessarily developing their understanding at the same rate, you know? And quite frankly, men were a little slower with this. It's real hard for us as men, and I've written about this extensively in my book. There's a chapter just about the psychology of fathers and special children challenge parents. And in fact, I'll often get men who don't like to read just that chapter. It could be a standalone chapter. But for men, it's real hard to talk about things we can't fix. We feel powerless. We want to fix the problem. Not that women don't want to fix the problem, but women are much more able to talk about things they can't fix and to get comfort from it. Men get upset about talking about things we can't fix, and we want to shut down.
Men, we kind of like we want to win. We want to be a winner.
Right. I'm not proud of this, Ernest, but it is true in a general way.
Yeah.
So men are on a little different trajectory with this, a little different course. But on the inside, I find in the work I do, what's going on the inside, how people really think and feel deep inside is relatively the same, men and women.
Yeah.
So real important, I think, to also pay attention to the relationship part. Where that comes in is that often the mom dives into this, and that's natural. That's natural.
Yes.
Nobody can do a better job diving in with all that has to be done. But often the father feels left out and outside the loop. So one of the things I've been able to do sometimes with couples is talk about this and ask the one who's less involved, and sometimes it's the mother. Sometimes there's a stay-at-home dad or a dad who's working nights and home in the day who's more involved. But I'll ask the one who's less involved, is there one area here you could take over and give your partner like a little breathing space? So, for example, one dad I know decided he would do research on sensory issues because he saw his son was really sensitive to sound and shut down in noisy situations. So he sort of became a mini expert on how to reduce the sound in his son's environment and you know, played a role in the IEP meetings and other things. Now, his wife, the mom, still did the lion's share of the work, but the dad, you know, developed a piece he could contribute to. Men want to be given something to do that makes a difference. So often, you know, if you want to get your husband more involved, give him a specific thing. Because, yeah, we want to win, we want to fix, we want to make a difference. But we don't tend to understand, you know, how this is all working. But if you give us a specific thing to do, that'll help us stand up to the plate and be a more active partner. So that's one way I approach that.
Okay. Well, that's good because I think that gives them, they feel a certain degree of ownership. Matter of fact, I was listening to someone talk about how men sort of want to be winners and they're that way when they, you know, they take ownership of a sports team. You know, if you're an Eagles fan, I'm a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, for example, and, you know, you get in there, you want to take ownership, and you want to be a winner, you want to be a part of it. And the fact that that wife gave him something to do where he felt that it was going to do something or contribute really, I'm sure, made him really feel really, really good. You know,
yeah,
just
he,
like
felt
he
good
felt,
about it.
You know, when
the
someone
example,
catches a touchdown pass, you know, it's like I was there to make the play, you know, that won the game. So good deal. Let's see here. Let me get a couple more questions here. Let's see. We've got one here from, let's see. Sorry about this. Sorry about the pregnant pause here.
I can maybe just give a bit of information. There's there's one website on the whole World Wide Web that's devoted exclusively to fathers of children with special needs, and that's fathersnetwork.org. It comes out of Seattle, Washington, fathersnetwork.org. And that's a really excellent resource about getting fathers involved, and many essays by fathers, and you know, many fathers of kids with autism have written for that website. So I'd highly recommend that. You'll see an essay or two of mine there. But that's a great website by and about and for dads, and the only one, like, so focused.
Okay. Let's see here. Here's a question here from Adrian, and her question is what do you do when your husband disagrees on how to handle tantrums? Because I know tantrums is a common problem, and, you know, you have two people who disagree with how it's done.
Well, often, you know, the disagreement often you need an objective person to talk to. Because, again, you sometimes you wind up in a power struggle, and everybody's losing, really.
Yeah.
There is a science to this. There are strategies which are proven more effective. But a lot of times, if people just can't agree or can't, like, just read something or have the same sense of it, it's good to get an objective point of view. That could be the child's teacher or speech therapist or, you know, professionals working with the child who have time to sit down with you, or a mental health professional who has experience with this sort of thing, or through a parent support group. There's a lot of ways, but often you need an outside voice to say, this is what's proven effective, whether it's tantrums or other behavioral problems. Often couples become polarized, and, you know, so one's being more hopeful, one's being more discouraged, and, you know, people just get kind of stuck, and it's understandable. So sometimes you just need an objective or outside point of view. And we have to be real careful with tantrums, because sometimes in our zeal to get the tantrum over with, we're actually providing a lot of attention and reinforcing it. And so it's not always intuitively obvious how to handle tantrums or how to handle kids fighting with each other. It's not always so obvious. Our sense of justice often gets in the way, and we think, well, this is right and this is wrong. And it gets in the way of couples solving a problem, that sense of, you know, I know what's right. And it's not that you both have to think exactly the same way or act exactly the same way, but it is important to have some common understanding of how to handle the big issues.
Gotcha. Well, I have one question here that probably will echo with a lot of people here, and that is they chose to use the name Worried from Chicago, and their question is, it seems impossible to manage a special needs child or two and two with full-time careers and a marriage and a household. Something has to give. How do people do it?
Oh, boy. She sounds exhausted, or he sounds exhausted. And
yeah,
it is
they
hard.
Do. They do.
It is hard. And two full-time jobs is very hard. It can be done. I think it requires other support, you know, whether that's, I mean, I know some people who do that who have a part-time or full-time nanny, or they have extra help in the home, or they have somebody's, one of the grandparents is living with them, or, you know, they have more support. What frequently happens is a mom who was planning to go back to work winds up not going back to work or only working part-time or getting her job scaled down a little bit, or a dad similarly might stay home for a while, take some family leave, or get a different job that allows more flexibility. So there's a lot of ways that people do it, but it is exceedingly hard. Real important, you might not have a lot of time to take care of yourself or each other, but steal a few minutes here and there.
Sure.
It's real important to try to have some balance, because basically our kids need us to be energetic and positive, and if we're worn down, we're not giving them that important emotional fuel that they need to grow.
Sure. Let's see here. We've got a question here from a woman from San Francisco, and she asks, any relationship strategies for an adult with Asperger's who is contemplating marriage?
Wow. Well, again, you know, this is an interesting area where there's increasingly lately a whole bunch of books coming out by people who have Asperger's and people who work with Asperger's, and there's a really good website, and you know, I'll speak on the issue a little, but I want to tell you about this website, and I think it's called aspires.org. I'm punching it in because I want to give it to you right. Okay, here it is. It's aspires-relationships.com. So www.aspires-relationships.com. And this is a great website that's dedicated to people with Asperger's syndrome as partners and individuals. It's a wonderful resource. About relationships and people with Asperger's, and they review books about Asperger's, and they have articles there. Actually, one of my articles is there. But a nice website to be in touch with.
Good. That's, I'm sure this person would love to hit that site there for sure.
And you know, basically, the things that all relationships need. People with Asperger's need. What's more challenging is that what is often intuitive to so-called neurotypical people is like learning a foreign language to somebody with Asperger's. The hardest thing is understanding how other people see you and what the other person's point of view is. But it's learnable. But it's more like learning a foreign language than flying by the seat of your pants. But many of us just fly by the seat of our pants and screw a lot of things up, too. So, you know, but I would use this website as a resource. There's some online support groups on the Yahoo Groups page. And if people want to email me through my website, I have some other resources, links and whatnot. But this is one of my favorite ones. I'll tell you one more. It's a website for people with Asperger's, and it doesn't focus on relationships, although it includes a lot of helpful information. It's called GRASP, GRASP.org. Which stands for Global and Regional Asperger Syndrome Partnership. This is a national organization. It has support groups in many cities. When you go to their website, you can find the groups near you. People of all ages with Asperger's go to these meetings. They're usually monthly meetings in a lot of areas, and they're very useful. And you can get hooked up through your local GRASP chapter with other resources in your area for people with Asperger's. So GRASP is definitely an organization, I think, very positive in our community and a good one to be in touch with.
Okay.
And loads of links on the GRASP website.
Oh, good. So that's GRASP, GRASP.org.
Right.
Good deal. Good deal. I have another comment here from a woman here from, her name is Overwhelmed, actually, and she's from Detroit, and she had a comment and a question, and her comment is, I would like to comment on the question, how do you do it? I work 2 to 3 days a week, usually just 4 hours. My husband works full time. We have no family support. That is, you know, I guess someone else to take care of the children. My ASD child has six. My ASD child is 6 years old, and I have 1 4-year-old. I do all medical research school, so it's hard to keep it together. At the end of the day, I don't have anything to give to my spouse. I'm worn out. I also say something has to give. Most men feel like their part in this is taking care of the finance. Do you have any comments about the latter? I guess people type these really
most
fast.
Men do sort of dive into trying to make more money and feeling like that's the way they can contribute. So I think, you know, your view of that's pretty accurate. And that's also because that's where often men, we think we can make a difference and we can't make a difference another way. And you know, well, let me talk about one of the elephants in the room. Nobody's asking about this specifically, but I think it's a pretty big factor for a lot of families. Having a child with autism definitely subtracts from the marriage, and everybody's like tired and edgy. Not unusual, more common. And the autism, as opposed to being romantic, is more like an anti-aphrodisiac. So here's the problem. In general, men may need sex to feel closer and to feel better and to cheer up. While on the other hand, women generally want to feel closer in order to feel romantic and sexual. So we're coming at this from different places. And it's the sort of, that's why I call it the elephant in the room. It's going on in a lot of relationships. The man wishing for more time, more sex, more romance. The woman too overwhelmed and wanting to feel taken care of more and closer in order to once again feel romantic and sexual. That's why it's really important to find even 5 or 10 minutes to spend with each other whenever you can and try to make your relationship rewarding again. There's really, you know, no substitute for that. And yes, this is exceedingly difficult. Often when I talk to people about this and I say, you know, take care of yourself, you know, you need it, your kid needs you to take care of yourself, they hear it like I'm giving them something else to do. Like, oh, my God, now I have that to do. I have OT, PT, speech. I got to go to, you know, special needs softball and special, you know, and now you're telling me to exercise and now you're telling me to spend time with my spouse. I'm going to fall apart. I can't do it. You know, people are really overwhelmed, but spending a little time taking care of the relationship can really help with these other things, can really help people work together better. The loss of intimacy, and by intimacy I don't mean sex, I mean closeness, I mean real sharing. The loss of intimacy when you're trying to raise a child with this disability is huge, and it just needs to be attended to a little. It's like a plant that needs water.
So you mentioned loss of intimacy, being closer, and I'm assuming too you mean, you know, just communication. Each person talking about how they feel about what's going on and being able to disclose that openly and to be heard. That's what I hear what you're saying. And I know as men, it's hard to do that, you know.
It's really hard, but I think our families need us to.
And,
you know, I think that's one of the challenges. And I think, you know, for myself, that's like probably the biggest thing I learned, that that my son needed me to do that, and I needed to do it. And, you know, I had to, you know, get past not being able to talk about my upsets. Often when I get just a small group of men together and ask them to tell their stories, it just all pours out. So it just pours out. At fathersnetwork.org, people can get, they put out a couple short videos that are just interviews with dads that are so compelling, and that men and women relate to. So I would, and they're very reasonably priced. I'd recommend those sorts of things. Fathers need role models of other men who can be open and see that, okay, you know, you're not, by being open, you're not being weak. The male point of view often is, if I talk about my upsets, I'm being weak, and I have to be strong for my family, meaning hold it in. But actually, often our families need us to open up and stop pretending that we can handle it, when really we're not handling it very well. We're just holding it in.
Well, I want to say you've gotten a few amens from the people that have posted here. I wish you could see it, but they keep popping up here. But a few people have said amen. Thank you so much for this conference. And they particularly, one woman, I won't give her name or location, but, you know, she had said in her marriage she'd had a similar problem. In fact, her husband had cheated once, in large part because of, you know, I guess what had been going on, and they've gotten past that, and now they've done what you said, which is, you know, make time for each other and learning how to communicate better, and now their sex life is back to where, you know, it once was. So, you know, it's,
well, that's
kind
great
of game
to hear.
Of game in. And, yeah, it is. It seems to be, you know, it's people really want to talk about this. And matter of fact, we've got probably like about 10 more questions in the past like 2 minutes here.
Wow. Oh, that hit a nerve. Good.
Yeah, I think so.
I really think that's like been in the closet of a lot of families.
Sure.
And, you know, couples that have kids with autism have all the problems that other couples have. It's not...
Exactly. On top of the set of...
Right, exactly. On top of the autism.
Right.
We are regular people with exceptional things we're dealing with.
Okay, we have one question here. I have a son who has autism who's 5 in preschool, and I'm in a new relationship and do not know how to keep my new relationship healthy. I wonder how to keep a healthy balance. That's kind of an open-ended comment, not necessarily a question, but I guess she's in a relationship with someone. She has a child that has autism. Clearly, you know, this... she might be feeling that maybe this might cause an issue with her current relationship. And I guess she kind of wants to know what to do. I mean, obviously the other person has to know the differences here and what might be involved with them when they, you know, relationship grows.
Right. Well, I think you're in a good situation. I'd encourage you, because if you are in a relationship with somebody who knows this child has autism and who cares for you and is getting involved with you, then, you know, that's just really hopeful. And there are a lot of great step parents in our autism community, as I mentioned a little earlier, if you were on the line. But I would say, you know, your new partner or new boyfriend, or I don't know what you want to call him, but I'm sure wants to help. See, well, Hallie wants to help. you know, take it slow because it's overwhelming. But often a new partner can be a great support. That was certainly true for me. My wife, Cindy, really helped me accept my son's disability. She was more objective than I was. She could see it more clearly. She didn't feel guilty. You know, so this can often work out great. But I'd say, you know, take it slow and steady and pay attention to the relationship. Don't view the relationship just as, you know, something that's going to help you with your son's autism. Mm-hmm. And do what you, you know, would do otherwise, you know.
Right.
And certainly I wish you well, and there's no reason that it can't work.
Mm-hmm.
It's a challenge, but it's, you know, it's workable.
Good. Good. Well, let's see here. Oh, let's see, it's hard to go through all these things here. Let's see. We have one woman from Pittsburgh. I'm trying to discern her question, but she says she has a friend who has a child with autism, and the mom is involved with this child's life, but the dad isn't. The dad is a behavioral specialist when he's not teaching. How can I help her? That sounds weird. Let me see if I can find another person here.
Well, look, I mean, I could just give a short answer. I mean, you're concerned about your friend. The best thing to do is just say, you know, I'm concerned about you. Is there a way I can be helpful? Is there a way I can be of service? Let me know. I care.
Right.
Just simply that. You don't have to fix it. You don't have to, you know, have any answers. But people really appreciate that. And she might say to you, oh, sometimes I just need a break. And then if you can, you know, watch your kid for a couple hours. Let her go shopping or get her hair done or see a movie or, you know, anything. But just say, how can I help? How can I be of service? I care.
Sure.
And that will feel so great to your friend.
Okay. Real good. I have another question here from her question is how can I help my husband accept the fact that our kids have the diagnosis of autism? How can I get him involved? And I really feel that he has left the responsibility over to my shoulders. I have a hard time to meet his needs in regards of intimacy when he is not meeting my needs of getting involved in the kids' needs.
Well, that's certainly, you know, the dilemma. And it's a little hard to answer in terms of like, the specifics because I don't know the people, you
sure.
know.
Right,
but,
right.
But, you know, it depends on the age of the kids. And she's talking about two kids with autism. It's almost unimaginable, yet so real. And I do know a lot of families like this. But sometimes just getting to the core of things, and I know these aren't the kids you dreamed of, that this is breaking your heart, and I know that it's breaking his.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes I'll look a man right in the eye and say, this isn't the kid you wanted. And I know that.
Mm-hmm.
And that just helps him to open up. It isn't the kid either one of you wanted. I'm sure you love him nonetheless and maybe more. But try to go, like, right to the heart if you can. And, you know, my philosophy of working with families is I try to just start where people are, and that means where each individual is. And he may really just be overwhelmed and wishes he could handle this better. So, and again, you might need an objective person to talk to. You might want to you know, print something out from the Father's Network website and leave it around that you think will speak to him. But catch him doing something right. Tell him what you appreciate about him. Even if he's working more to pay these bills, let him know what you appreciate. That
sure.
also breaks the ice.
You know, I'm glad you said that because, you know, it's saying catching your mate doing something right. And I know as a husband, because I have a newborn baby boy now, and, you know, I work here at home, so I spend a lot of time with him. And the other day my wife said, honey, I just want to thank you for taking care of the baby today, you know, and you know, making sure that he was washed and all those. And just to hear that, even though I know I'm supposed to do it, but the fact that she said it, that she appreciates it, it just goes a long way. It really does. You know, it makes you feel like
you just wanted to melt there.
You want to puff your chest out, basically, because, you know, it's there. So I can only imagine what it's like, you know, when families are going through this and you know, you're going through all these details and then someone says something like that. It does really get your attention. It does help. I can attest to that, I should say.
Yeah.
So we have another question here. This is a woman who asked, I won't give her name out, but her question is my marriage has already ended, and what recommendations and suggestions do you have for beginning again with a spectrum high-functioning child who happens to be 20 years old who will not be placed outside the home for residential care? So I guess she has a child who's who will not be.
Will not be.
Yes. So, similar response, I'm guessing, from the previous caller, I think.
Right, except it doesn't sound like she's in a relationship, but she's hoping to be. I would say just by being open and honest, that's the way to start. And young people with autism can be very endearing, and a lot of people can really enjoy somebody with autism or and high functioning autism, but you know, obviously you're looking for somebody that's compatible with you and compatible with your, you know, now adult or virtually adult child. So it's a little more complicated. However, in the age of the internet, you could put out here like who you are and what your life's about and what kind of person you're looking for, and it's amazing how people find each other now. It's like much easier actually in some ways to find somebody, you know, that meets certain criteria that and that knows about autism or understands it, either, you know, they grew up with somebody with autism or they worked in schools or whatever. So I think just being open and honest, you can start again, and you can live, and you can have a full life. I really believe that. Not that it's easy, but that it's really possible. And not far out.
Right. Someone had just given me a comment to repeat the information on the Father's Network again, so I'm going to do that. It's fathersnetwork.com, correct?
.org.
.org. Okay, sorry. It's fathersnetwork.org. And that's got the information on the fathers, some of the videos that are on there that where they interview fathers and they talk about what their experience is like with children with special needs. So that's a good resource. I'm definitely sure people are going to pick that one up. I'm glad.
They also list fathers support groups, various ones that are around the country. So people may find local contacts there, too, although it's a Washington State website. It has a lot of national resources.
Right. We have another person here whose nickname is Power of Praise in California, and their comment was, one learns about the constant praise with children on the spectrum and even normal, well, I guess it's neurotypical kids. Well, they like what you said about adults can use the praise tool, too, some more than others. So that's a pretty good comment.
Sure, we all want that. I mean, who doesn't want that? You know, here's a place I can put in another tip in terms of women who want to create some better communication, and their partners are having trouble listening or having trouble talking. And I learned this from my wife and my daughters, my teenage daughters. They will say to me, "Dad, just listen. You don't have to do anything. I just need you to listen." And so if you relieve us, and by us I mean men, if you relieve us of that idea in our heads that we have to do something about what you're saying, it makes it easier for us to listen. So so I coach women to say, tell them to just listen. That's all I need. I'll love it if I can just talk to you about this. Just listen. And then that'll often let him listen. You don't have to do anything.
Right.
And then you could couple that with tell him if there is something he can do that's useful for you. Like, I just need a break sometimes.
Right.
He'll probably do it. But
yeah.
If you just want him to listen all the time, that's too frustrating.
Sure.
You know, but tell him you don't have to do anything. I need to vent. I just need to talk about this. And you can, if you just listen, I'll feel better. And,
sure.
And when there is something he can actually do that you'll feel good about, let him know what that is. If you need a break, tell him, I just need a break for 15 minutes. I'll love you for that. You know, and you can get some of those things actually working, and you'll both feel better.
Yeah. Well, let's see here. We have got another person here that says, bingo, he hit the nail on the head with that statement. So they got a lot of good comments here. We have one question that's, I guess, that's kind of more of a question regarding, I guess, how to diagnose or evaluate something. I'm going to ask it, and I guess you determine whether you can answer it. And their question is how do you determine if it is Asperger's or just high-functioning autism? I mean, I guess that's for
psychologist. You know, here's the thing. Tony Atwood, who's probably like one of the eminent authorities in the world on this, says, tongue-in-cheek, the difference between high-functioning autism and Asperger's is the spelling. You know, so there's often not much of a difference. I mean, I could talk to you about it, but frankly, it there's not much of a difference when we talk about the autism spectrum. But what we're referring to, however, is that with Asperger's, the language is pretty spontaneous, that intelligence is normal or above, and that the primary problem is social. You know, not a lot of the other sorts of symptoms, little to none, but primarily social. But kids and adults with autism learn and develop through their lifetime. So they're often becoming less symptomatic and moving along the spectrum. Some, Stephen Shore, for example, who's a friend and colleague of mine, was nonverbal at 4, and this past year got his doctorate in special education, and next year he'll be a professor of special education. And he was nonverbal at 4 and kind of developed all the way through the spectrum up to Asperger's. So it's kind of a fluid diagnosis, but we're certainly looking for very good language skills and normal to above intelligence for high-functioning autism and Asperger's. But with Asperger's, little to no other symptoms other than social skills. That's the simplest answer I could give. But don't get hung up on it. It's not that important.
All right. We have another question here from New York. They have just joined the call, and they have a question, and that is in a comment. It says, my husband does not believe our son has PDD and OS. He fights me constantly and basically undoes everything I try to accomplish with our son. It has been very frustrating and causes a lot of resentment that our children feel. He thinks my son just needs to mature. He is very mild, but there are issues to contend with. I feel as if I'm alone in this, and I'm angry and contemplating divorce, but I'm afraid how my children will handle this. Any suggestions on how to get him to open up? He will not even read the description of PDD-NLS. Unfortunately, the arguing between us is terrible, and I feel it sets my son back continuously.
Well,
that's a lot.
That's a lot.
Sounds like she might
you
need
may,
a visit.
Listen, sometimes, I'm going to talk about this, but I'm going to suggest that you, the person with this question, get some professional guidance. You clearly want to keep your family together, and it may really help to get a third party in there who can look at this with you and give you some suggestions based on your personality, and even if your husband won't go. But I would certainly immediately stop fighting about the diagnosis and just focus on what you could do together to help your kid. I just have the general belief that parents love their kids and want to help them. And when there's a disagreement like this, I just try to focus on what do we need to do to help our kid. And sometimes, many times, fathers take longer to wrap their minds around this because we can't fix it. It's hard to understand, you know, et cetera. Some of the best adjusted fathers I know told me that they started out the same way, and I said to one guy, like, how did you change? Like, how did you go from being this guy who didn't want to be bothered and couldn't talk about it to being so involved? And he said, well, my wife had a relative who died, you know, in the Midwest. They were on the East Coast, and she went to the funeral, and I was home for a weekend with my kids, and in those 3 days, I saw what her life was like, and I changed. Sometimes the intervention is go out for a while. Leave them with the kids.
Right.
Let them see what it's really like. Don't do all the work. Sometimes that's very powerful. But again, I don't know you. I don't know your situation. That might not be the right move for you. But it's definitely worth it to work on the marriage and try to find a way to stay together. But it's not always possible. But I would definitely, I always tell people in this kind of situation, it's better to try too long and too hard than to walk away and wish you tried harder. If you try as hard as you can and you know there's absolutely nothing else you could do and you think, well, maybe I stayed in the marriage a year or two too long, you won't be guilty. But if you sort of blow it up and walk away without getting help and without trying, you may be haunted with guilt the rest of your life. So I would say try to get some help. Talk to your doctor, your priest or rabbi or minister. Talk to someone who can refer you or help you.
Okay. Well, you know, I wanted to talk about something here, which will probably be another conference call some other time. But we had a couple of comments from people here recently that are asking about autism and insurance. Are you familiar with sort of what's happening in that particular arena?
A little.
I know a number of states are trying to, you know, produce initiatives and laws that will come into effect that will allow people to cover, you know, certain therapies through
Right.
You know,
I mean, there's definitely a whole movement around this. Like Pennsylvania just passed a law in the end of the spring session, although it doesn't go into effect till next year. I think there's a movement afoot for this, and I don't know how. And there's certainly federal proposals. I would say, you know, without becoming overtly political, to go to the websites of the presidential candidates and read their autism positions and read their proposals. Both candidates list their autism proposals, what they support, et cetera. And, you know, just go to those websites, put in autism, and it's you'll see what's going on with that. And the important thing is not just the support of it, but the funding of it. whether that's insurance or increased services or increased medical coverage for kids on the spectrum. The important thing, or research, the important thing is not the support of the concept, but the support of the funding for the concept.
Right. Well, let's see here. That brings us to another question, and I have one question here that is from a mom who asked this. She has a son with autism who's 5 years old, and he hasn't sort of asked about how he's different from other kids yet. And her daughter kind of says in front of him how he doesn't, you know, look at him and or her and doesn't want to play with her a lot. She wants to know when is a good age or when's a good time to tell him. How should she tell him what's, you know, different about him?
Well, it's hard to answer without knowing more about him, but as soon as he's old enough to understand it, as soon as you can see him noticing it, it's certainly, you know, time to be talking to her daughter about it. And it's never too soon to just sort of talk openly and simply, like, Billy's different. He doesn't look in people's eyes the way you do. His brain is different, like, just in real general ways. And then, again, it helps to talk to somebody who knows the child, because I don't know his cognitive level, what he understands, but see what his teacher thinks. You know, look at the Cats Have Asperger's Syndrome book.
Sure.
You know, it's really an individual question based on when can your child understand it. And that's how you, that's kind of the guideline to keep in your head. But for your daughter who's talking about it, that means she's old enough for you to be talking to her about it. She's noticing, and she needs the validation, and she needs to know, you know, that, yes, this is difficult, you know, sometimes for her, but she definitely needs you to talk to her, and he will at some point, if not now.
Mm-hmm.
And he may be in a smaller class and wonder why he's in a smaller class, or he may be in the small class and not notice and not care, and it's not time to talk to him. But I'd ask his teacher and other professionals who are working with him.
Right. Okay. Let's see here. We have one question from a woman who's in a situation where she has in-laws who do not believe in autism. And apparently she has 4 children, 3 of which, she says, are neurotypical children, and 1 of which has autism. And they kind of feel that this is not true. And as a result, it causes a strain in her relationship between her and her husband, and she kind of wants to know what to do. It's a tough question to answer, but, you know, I figured, you know, maybe you can point to her some resources that can help her out, or maybe how to take a stance on something like this.
Well, you know, families are different, and I don't know why they don't believe it, and you don't know why they don't believe it.
Sure.
Sometimes, and there's a lot we have to accept about autism, not just our kids' condition, but there's just a lot we have to accept, and one of the things we have to accept is not everybody gets it, and people only get it when they get it. And often the people that spend the most time around your kid, they are the ones who get it. And the ones who spend the least time don't get it. And it's a hard thing to believe. It's a hard thing to wrap your mind around. And it's good to try to maintain compassion for people who can't wrap their mind around it, because once upon a time, that was all of us. Once upon a time, none of us understood this. And it was hard.
Right.
So sometimes it just takes time. Some people come around, some people don't. That's just part of the life that we have as parents. try not to fight about it with your spouse. It's not like there's a good family versus a bad family. That's an argument a lot of couples get into with or without autism. It's not a good argument.
Yeah,
the other thing, it's just not a good argument.
Yeah.
Your family's crazier than mine.
Well, you know, there's one on every block.
Right. There's one on every block. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
The other piece of this, and it's sort of like I talked about, you know, people's sex lives being the elephant in the room. Another elephant in the room is the genetic issue. Autism is a genetic disorder. And where it exists, there's genes often on both sides that just kind of collided. And there's other, if not autistic people, quirky people, or people with serious mental illness that exist within the extended family, and nobody wants to believe the genes came from them. So part of not believing it may also be a fear, either unspoken or unconscious, that these genes couldn't have come from our side. How could these people have produced this kid? It's not on account of us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not really possible to change other people. All we have power over, in my view, is our own relationships. So I would, you know, just try to go on, not get caught up in this argument, because it will only bring you hardship and suffering.
Gotcha. Okay. I wanted to put up another question here, and that is, I have a question from someone here who says she's from Little Rock, and her question is, what is the best way to discipline a child with high-functioning autism? Nothing seems to work. She, you know, tries to call him on something that he's done, and then 5 minutes later he doesn't understand why he's in trouble. I guess this is kind of a generic question, but how does one discipline a child? I mean, I guess it's a tough question for you to answer because each child's different and you don't know them, but maybe...
Right, I mean, that... therefore I can't say how do you discipline your child, you know, but I would agree with you, Ernest, that every child's different and we have to understand them. Now, on this question of high-functioning autism, you know, we talked about this a little before. Some people think that because a child is verbal that they have high-functioning autism. That's not necessarily true. High-functioning autism is also what's the child's cognitive level. Is their intelligence and achievement average or above? That's what we're generally talking about. So a child could be very verbal, talking a whole lot, but not really understanding the, you know, certain rules, or they may be very impulsive or compulsive and not be able to follow certain rules. So the key thing that we have to understand with discipline is that it has to be based on who the child is and their needs. And this child may not understand as much as you think. And the behavior may have a meaning that eludes you at present. So this is another situation where it's really good to get a behavioral specialist involved to analyze the behavior and help figure out what are good strategies based on your child, based on what strategies are comfortable for you, on what your child understands and what your child doesn't. Often, with any child, even a typical child, we keep trying the same thing, thinking that it'll work, and it's not working, and we need another point of view. Freud's definition of neurosis was, which I think is definitely worth thinking about, not that I'm a Freudian, is it's doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. So if you're trying the same thing over and over again, and it's not working, back up. Realize that's not working, and get a different point of view. Get some help with this. And I think you can make progress.
Okay. Well, could you talk to us a little bit about your practice, you know, kind of what you do? because I'm sure a lot of people out there have a lot, many more questions once they kind of find out a little bit kind of what your specialty is. And for those of you that haven't posted a question yet, please do. We have them here for about another 39 minutes, and so please post your questions now. But could you talk a little bit about your practice, kind of what you do, and give us an idea of what your specialties are, so that people kind of
have
a better idea of what to ask.
Sure. Well, what I specialize in is the family issues around autism and other disabilities. So how it affects couples, typically developing children, and that sort of thing. I work with some teenagers and adults with Asperger's and high-functioning autism. We also have other therapists in the practice who work with families. My partner and my wife, Dr. Ariel, works with parents. We have some therapists who work with children. We do diagnostic evaluations and second opinions to help people who either need a diagnosis to get services or who want another opinion because they're not sure it's autism or they want a more in-depth look at the level of it and that sort of thing. So a wide variety of services around the special needs issues and families. And as I mentioned at the beginning, we have a website, alternativechoices.com. And if you go to the special families page, you could sign up for a newsletter I do monthly on these issues. And my books are available on Amazon.com.
Okay, great. I'm going to send an email, actually, out after the call. I can look up your book and just include the link in there so that they can purchase it.
Okay, great.
But that gives people an idea here. I have a total of 57 questions, but a lot of those are comments. So once again, everyone, if you have a question, this is the time to get it in. We have one woman here who commented from New York, and she said there's a lot of talk about curing autism, and she seems to feel that this gives parents kind of a false hope. And her concern also is, or the comment too, is why is there such a growth in autism with girls? So maybe you can comment on those two things.
Okay, that's a real interesting question, and I'll try to talk about both of these.
Okay.
It used to be, just a few years ago, scientists thought autism existed on about 12 to 15 genes. And the genes are triggered by either stressors in the environment or toxins, but the genes are triggered. And there's many genes. So the reason, and we don't have a cure, and a cure is not even close because there's so many genes involved. With something like cystic fibrosis, there's one gene involved, and scientists believe that there will be a cure probably within a decade because of the advances in genetic intervention and other sorts of things that I don't understand entirely, but there's one gene involved. With autism, there's many genes involved, making a cure very far away, if at all possible. And the leading, a lot of the leading scientists view it, autism, more a condition like cancer in the sense of there's many of them. And you need different approaches, for different kinds. But early on, who wouldn't want a cure? And if there was a cure, I'd be in line with everybody else. I could tell you that. So,
sure.
But it's not like I'm expecting it from my knowledge of this. Now, why is there an increase among girls? I'm glad to hear it, and I'll tell you why. Girls, in general, when they have mental and emotional problems, it's more inner. And with boys, it more comes out in their behavior. So girls on the spectrum have a slightly different profile and are often overlooked and not diagnosed because they don't present the same behavioral challenges. Recently, I went to a seminar that was given by a psychologist from Australia, And she reported that they were diagnosing almost equal numbers of teenagers with high-functioning autism and Asperger's, which was startling because here it's 7 or 8 to 1, boys to girls. But what the difference is in Australia is because they have basically socialized medicine, every kid is getting screened. Every kid's getting screened, so they're identifying more girls.
Sure.
So if we improve our system of early diagnosis and intervention, and it has been improving, we will identify more girls. It's not so much that all of a sudden more girls have it as that we're identifying the girls and helping them. But we're still way behind on that. And in special ed in general, girls are underrepresented, not diagnosed at nearly as much as they should be, because their problems tend to be more inner than outer, a little less behavioral in general. There's also few but some good books about girls and autism. So, again, if you go to Amazon and put in girls and autism, it's a small list. It's a growing list. And real interesting kind of essays and discussion about how this looks different.
Sure. I have one more question here, and this is Susan, who actually is from India. She's listening online, and that's the beauty of this whole thing here, is we can talk to people from all over the world. And she has a question. She has an issue with a mother-in-law who says negative things about her 4-year-old child who has autism directly in front of him. And I guess she's having a hard time figuring out how to address this issue with her.
Wow.
I mean, my solution would be to say, stop it. But I'm sure there's a much more eloquent way of making the other person empathize with not doing that in a way that doesn't offend them.
Right.
Maybe have a better way.
Maybe you could just say, of course, you want your mother-in-law to stop, and she may be embarrassed by your child's behavior. She may not understand it. But whatever the case, I mean, maybe one way to approach this is to say, he really needs to hear positive things from you. That will help him. Kids with autism, like all kids, you know, need our support, need our love, need our encouragement. And so she's finding his behavior unacceptable. She wants it to be different. I try to tell her the way to help them be different is to be positive, to accept them as he is and help them grow. That's as simple as I could put it. And I'd be kind of gentle but persistent in saying this. And I know it upsets you, and that's appropriate. This is your child, and it is your job to, you know, protect him and help him grow. Your mother-in-law also deserves respect, but not at the expense of your child. So I urge you not to be silent, but as diplomatically as you can to ask her to be positive with your child.
Okay. Okay, really good. We have another question here. I guess people are coming here on the call a little later, but this may have been answered before, but maybe you could repeat it if it has, and that is, if it's not already answered, what do you feel ways can strengthen the marriage? And I think you mentioned, I believe, was 3 things. Take a break, catch your partner doing something right by praising them, and then, of course, you know, spend more time together between the two of you.
Right. And so we talk about those things, and often I'll just sort of add a little to it that I meant to bring up before. Sometimes people will finally get a little time and all they talk about is their child with autism because it's been such a challenge. So I would say also take breaks from talking about autism because it's consuming. So take a break, have some fun, even if that's just a 10-minute walk or share a cup of tea or if you can, go on a date. If you can't go out for a date, have an in-home date. Sometimes you could even have a babysitter, you know, upstairs with the kids, and you could have a nice dinner. There's a lot of creative ways couples, you know, can spend time together, do activities together you like. But don't give up on the marriage and don't neglect the marriage.
Sure.
Because
sure.
The marriage is the glue that holds the family together.
It sure is. It sure is. Well, let's see. And we're up to 71 questions and comments.
Wow. Well, you know, here's another point about this.
Later.
Wow.
I'm sorry?
Well, that's great. You know, another point, you know, often, you know, in marriage, just, you know, like when we have a kid, we have to accept who the kid really is, who's usually not the kid we dreamed of in some form or another. Even the most gifted kid is, or the most typical kid's not the one we dreamed of. It's a real person. And when we get married, we expect our partner to meet our needs. But then we have a real partner. We have to accept the real person and what it's really like with each other. So that's the other thing that's going on in every house, and it would be going on whether you had the kid with autism or not. You're spending these years together, and you're, you know, finding each other's strengths and weaknesses and learning about each other and often having to accept things that we wish weren't true. That's going on in every marriage, and the autism compounds it. But one thing that really helps is the people that get through it and are happy often they just stay committed. They don't solve
sure.
every problem, but they stay committed and they get through it because they stay committed. So
right.
I definitely
right.
encourage you to look at it that way.
Yes. Well, let's see here. We have a couple more questions that have come in. And one person asks, Harm, this is kind of might put you on the spot here, but they ask, what are the three reasons why you think couples who have children with autism divorce?
I think they divorce for the same reasons other people divorce.
Which is?
Which is, you know.
I mean, you mentioned the pressure, of course, and all the other things on top of what most couples do. I mean, I guess money is one, and failure
money,
to communicate.
Money, sex, and power are the things people
sorry?
Fight about. Money, sex, and power are what people fight yep. about. What they disagree about, what they're in conflict about. They're like the big three. And, you know, okay, an interesting website about marriage in general is Gottman.com, GOTTMAN.com. John Gottman is at the University of Washington in Seattle, and he's one of the world's leading researchers on marriage and divorce. And he developed a way that he could spend time with a couple and pretty accurately predict whether they would divorce or not. And here's some of his findings. And you can look it up on his website. I don't know all this off the
test,
top
right?
of my head. What?
It's like a test, right? It's like a multiple
yeah,
choice.
Yeah, he has some things like that. And the marriages where people are critical of each other, critical, not, and he differentiates between a complaint and being critical, just putting each other down, or one person putting the other down, high risk of divorce where people are critical. So he's got a whole system there of, and he studied like hundreds and maybe thousands of couples, and can predict marriages that are likely to fail. But it's, and I'm oversimplifying it, but the negativity of people toward each other is the primary thing that breaks them up. And you can, I'd highly recommend his books about marriage, John Gottman, and I'll look you up a title or two while we're talking. And another book I would recommend about marriage that's really good is called Grown Up Marriage by Judith Viorst. Some of you might recognize her. She also writes children's books. But she wrote a book about marriage called Grown Up Marriage, you know, where she talks about marriages that make it and marriages that don't, and the qualities that they have. So the marriage is, but here's the important thing. The not so much the negativity, being mean to each other, is a little oversimplified, but that's the reason people break up. The reason people stay together and find happiness in the long term is they're best buddies. And research shows this over and over and over again. That the people who are married a long time and happy call each other their best friends. Okay, here's the title of one of the Gottman books, The Seven Principles for Making Marriage Work by John Gottman.
Okay.
And so he approaches it from the positive point of view, and of course he does show you that the marriages that don't have some of these qualities are the ones at risk.
Right.
And you can read a lot of it on his website, Gottman.com, for free.
Okay. So that's GOTTMAN.com.
That's right.
Good deal.
And I have a chapter in my book, Special Children Challenge Parents, about what couples need and you know, goes in more detail about some of the things we're talking about tonight.
Tell me how you kind of started to, you know, what motivated you to write that book. I mean, clearly you deal with patients all the time, but tell me kind of how that got started.
It really, you know, my interest in this started with my son's autism, and I, you know, he's going to be 29 now, and there wasn't really much available in the way of help for parents, and I was in graduate school at the time. I was a school teacher, and I decided I wanted to find out what helps parents when they have a child with a disability. So that's what I studied for my doctoral research. And I interviewed families, not who were falling apart, but who were coping well, to see what they were doing, how they were caring for their child, how they were taking care of their other kids, how their marriage was working. And, you know, that's how I started out. And then I began speaking to groups of parents, speaking at conferences, and that sort of thing, sharing what I learned. And in my practice, providing counseling to families going through this, as well as general psychological services. But as time has gone on, most of my time is now spent with families that have children with special needs and in particular, mostly autism, although other conditions as well. Because the dynamics are largely the same, while the conditions may be different. The impact on couples, on the siblings, et cetera, are similar. So I kind of became an interpreter between the professional world and the parent world. And while this was going on, my son's autism was very severe. He doesn't speak or write or read, and he's really required a lifetime of care. So it certainly, I kind of paid my dues that way. And
sure,
there's not too much people can tell me that horrifies me, so I became very good at listening and helping people sort this stuff out.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And if you could, too, address, you know, the issue of a child, a much older child, because who has autism, because most of the people that call in here typically have kids that are younger. What's involved with the care of your son? And, you know, how did you plan this out? You know, what things do you think they should do for those of the parents that have children that have severe autism, what type of planning do they need to start making now while they're still young?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a wide range of possibilities, and it's hard to know early on. Of course, we all want our kids to, like, grow up, be independent, marry if possible, go to college if possible, have a good job. We want the best for them, but we don't know what's possible. And So learning to kind of live with the uncertainty is what we all have to work with. And it's the same as with typically developing children. We don't know who they're going to grow up to be. That being said, when the autism is more severe, we're really, and you might know this by the time your child's 8 or 9, that it's really looking like they'll need a lifetime of care, then it's worth it to start looking into how this goes on in your state, what's available. Now, this is all kind of developing as we speak. My son lives in a group home in the county I live in and goes to a day program. It's not, you know, what I ever would have dreamed of for him, but he actually lives in a very nice home in a used-to-be rural area, now suburban area, that's just developed a lot. Gets 3 hot meals a day, and he goes to a day program where he does some simple vocational things and recreational things, arts and crafts and that sort of thing. And he generally has a pretty good day. He's pretty happy most of the time, but, you know, but his life is limited. But he's generally happy within himself.
Mm-hmm.
People have a stereotype in their heads often, and I did too, of what group homes are like and what services are like for adults with disabilities, autism in particular. But if you have a child that's in this so-called lower functioning area or more classic autism, it really helps to look at some of these programs. I think you'll find they're not what you think, and they're a lot nicer than what you think. And that'll kind of help you as you plan for the future. These services are being developed more in most places, and certainly a lot remains to be done. There are not enough services for adults with autism. So I'd encourage people to get involved with, you know, your local and national autism organizations, and be, in that sense, part of the solution. There is a lot going on now, and I think that'll continue. You know, likewise, there's a lot of politics to this. As we talked about earlier, in many states there's proposals to expand insurance coverage so that they have to cover the therapies our kids need. So see what's going on in your state. Get involved. See the candidates' positions. Help to elect candidates that, you know, will advocate for things that help our kids. These are all ways to plan for the future and make a good future for our kids. So that's the way I would look at this, whether your child has classic autism or Asperger's or high-functioning autism or PDD-NOS. And I'll throw in one more thing here about the NOS. Not otherwise specified it stands for, but I tell people, think about that as not all the symptoms. Every category in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, depression, anxiety, they all have an NOS character, and it means they all have an NOS at the end within the classification. And it means having not all of the symptoms, but enough symptoms to consider this diagnosis. So it's generally, that's a good way to understand it. It's part of the autism spectrum, but not all the symptoms that would qualify to be classic autism. High-functioning autism is actually not a category, but we use it otherwise.
Okay. Well, let's see here. A few more questions have come in here. And one of the ones, let's see here. We have, here we go. Here we have a question here, and that is, one person wanted to know what your website address was again. I'm sorry.
Now, no spaces, alternativechoices.com.
Okay. And we had one other person who asked about the title of the book, I believe it was Grown Up Marriage, and they wanted to know the author's name.
That's Judith Viorst, V-I-O-R-S-T, and that is in paperback. It's around $10.
Okay.
Wonderful little book.
So that's
book.
Judith Viorst, and that's Grown Up Marriage. Someone had asked that question. Let's see here. We have... let's see, we have one question here from Victoria, Texas. And When, with all the emotions a parent feels when receiving an autism diagnosis for your child, how do you stay on the same page with your spouse and maintain a unified front for your child?
Well, you know, this is the kind of thing we've been talking about all night. In
yeah.
some ways, I'd say, let it go. You're two different people, and you're not always on the same page. If you let that go, you'll start to find your common ground. And try to find it simply. And by that I mean, this is your kid. I'm sure you both love him or her. And do your best to help them. Do your best to talk openly and honestly. Tell your spouse what they're doing right. Ask in a specific way for the help you need. This will help you feel together. I think that's what people mean by on the same page. You're never going to think and feel the same way at every moment, but how can you feel more together in it? And I think a lot of that's the openness, the honesty. Women want to talk about this more. Men don't want to talk about it. I tried to give some tips for that. There's some of that in my book. You know, and you can certainly write to me, and I'll write more about this on my newsletter. Try to view it like a process that you're both going at different rates and from different perspectives. Be patient with each other. Be compassionate and understanding. And often, as men, we're a little slower on the uptake with these things. We really want to fix it. We really want to keep our families safe, and this is something we're powerless over. Not that women are not also powerless. We are all powerless over this. But what we have power over, and I think this is one of the lessons of autism, we don't have the power to cure it or fix it or make it go away, but we do have power over how we relate to our child and how we relate to our family. And if we focus in there, it's going to work out better. It's just going to work out better.
I have another question here from New York, actually, and they ask, how does Asperger's and PDS or PDD NOS differ? My son was diagnosed with mild PDD NOS, but he leans more towards Asperger's.
That well might be true. Because kids, the PDD NOS means not having all the symptoms required for autism. Asperger's further means spontaneous and age-appropriate speech and language and average or above intelligence. And the primary deficit in Asperger's is social skills, not speech and language, not intelligence or cognitive skills. So, to some extent, it doesn't matter, because what you always want to look at is, where's my child now? What does he or she need, you know, to advance? So in that way, if your child's getting good services and learning, you really don't need to get so hung up on the label. It's all autism spectrum. And kids and adults grow and develop and actually at times become less symptomatic. So your child may have been PDD NOS, maybe closer to Asperger's now. You could, if you want to, you could certainly could have a full diagnostic workup with people who specialize in it. And this can be measured through observational testing, observation and testing. But it's not something, obviously, by blood work. It's really by behavior and observation. So, you know, two professionals could come up with slightly different opinions. But I would try not to get hung up on this and just focus on what your kid needs.
Sure. We have another question here. They want to know how to get on your mailing list. I believe they go to your website, and maybe you can elaborate.
Go to the website. Click on the button that says Special Families, and down at the bottom there's a box that says Sign Up for Our Newsletter, and you can just put in your email address, and you'll get the next newsletter, which I'll be doing in the next few days.
Okay, great. We have a really great question here from Queens, New York, and her question is, what services do you find work best over the years for a child with autism? And the second question is, what are your views on the brushing therapy? And three, how do we get respite care?
Well, okay. Feed me those one at a time. I can't answer
okay.
them.
Okay. We can go the first one, and that is, what services do you find work best over the years for a child with autism?
Well, you know, it varies. Each child has an individual profile. So, but in general, kids with autism need speech and language therapy. Many of them need occupational therapy, and that's where the brushing comes in. And they need special education services, behavioral therapies. But it's sort of a menu that of things, like a Chinese restaurant menu, that has to be adapted based on the level of the child and the specific symptoms that your child has. So hopefully you have a professional team of people in your child's school and maybe outside private people who are giving their input, and you're putting together the therapies that work best. Now, one of the problems parents run into is they go to specialists, and all the specialists recommend what they do. And that can be a problem because a lot of people are out here selling the services. But the way you evaluate it is to see what is helping your child, and just evolve your child's program that way. And, you know, this is like the general menu. Now, in terms of the brushing therapy, that's part of occupational therapy, and those things are really helpful. Again, you'd want a good occupational therapist to evaluate your child and recommend what kinds of sensory activities would be helpful. Brushing is one of many. So brushing might not be what your kid needs, but they might need deep pressure, they might need... you know, desensitization to certain sounds. A book you might want to look at is The Out of Sync Child that talks about sensory problems and what can be done about them. But you want an occupational therapist to do a good evaluation and recommend specifics that would be helpful to your child. Mm-hmm. And was there another one? Other question in there?
Yes, there was. What are your views? Oh, you already asked to answer the one on brushing therapy. And how do we get respite care?
Respite care. Actually,
I have a link on my website, actually, that has a link on respite care. One of the websites I have is autism-pdd.net. That's autism-pdd.net. And there's a link on there on respite care. And
there's a national respite locator site.
Oh, good. That's even better.
I'm looking it up right now. And, you know, it varies by states. Okay, here it is. This is a national website, and it helps you find local respite care. It's called archrespite.org, A-R-C-H, respite.org. And there was... I guess about a year ago, some federal legislation and funding to help develop respite care in the state in around the country, respite care through the lifespan. Now, it's not easy to come by. There's a lot of sort of do-it-yourself approaches, like taking turns with other families. If you can't find these services available, I'd say don't give up. And people are doing this through their churches and community organizations and that sort of thing, as well as through social service agencies. But the website I gave you, archrespite.org, is a good one.
Okay. I have an interesting question here from a woman in Little Rock, Arkansas, I'm guessing. And her question is since it isn't a good thing to apologize for your child being autistic, what is a good way to let a stranger in public know that your child has autism while your child is running up to them, pulling on their clothes, trying to show them his favorite toy?
Well, the Autism Society of America for many years has had these little cards about the size of business cards that give a short explanation of autism. And that's, a lot of people will carry these with them and give them out in such a situation. It really depends, you know, kind of what you're comfortable with. But, you know, that's one way that, that parents have been dealing with this for a good while now.
Sure.
And I think they're still available through the Autism Society of America.
Okay.
So,
and let's see here. That's, I guess we're getting pretty close down to the last 5 minutes now. And we had another person that asked, what's the name of your website again? Sorry about this, but I'm going to have to email these out, but maybe if you can repeat it one more time.
AlternativeChoices.com.
Okay. AlternativeChoices.com.
And go to the Special Families button, and down the bottom of that page, you could sign up for the newsletter. Just put your email in the box.
Okay, good deal. And let's see here. We have one question here again. What about alternative treatments? Have any been successful? And why do insurance companies not cover any of these?
Well, they don't cover an awful lot of things, not just alternative treatments. Oh, and actually, I see you can also get the email newsletter on the homepage. There's a box that just says join our email list on alternativechoices.com. And you just put in your email list and click join, and you're on. The alternative, here's the thing. You'll want to put together a good basic program involving education and the basic therapies, speech, OT, behavioral therapy. Beyond that, people may want to try alternative therapies. The reason, not just the reason insurance companies don't cover them, but there's, on many of them, there's scarce data of effectiveness and just what's called anecdotal reports, like so-and-so gave these vitamins to their kid and then they started talking, as opposed to a scientific study. So many of these things do not have scientific evidence that backs them up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's not just that insurance companies don't pay for them, but that's why they're not highly recommended, which is not to say that some of these things might not help some children. I think the important thing is to do what makes sense for you. Get a good basic program going with education and basic therapies, and then, based on how your child learns, look at what's out here and see if there's something that's worth trying. That's reasonable, but be careful in terms of what's the side effects and what's the evidence. There's a lot of parents feel desperate and you want to do everything, and you want to cure if you can get it, but look at what the evidence is, and look at what the possible side effects are, because sometimes they're serious.
Okay. Well, Dr. Robin Nassif, I want to say thank you so much for taking the time to answer our questions. I wish there was more questions. I guess it's a slow Wednesday for a lot of people, but we had a total of about 89 questions and comments that came in over the time that you spoke. I want to say you've obviously helped strengthen a lot of marriages here. People asked a lot of questions about that. And you've also answered a lot of questions about treatment, which I think people are going to find very helpful. So I want to thank you so much for your time. And I want to say for those of you that are still on the line, as you know, we do these calls for free. And, you know, you can call in and listen as long as you want and ask as many questions as you want. We need to know what you think. And to do that, there should be a link at the bottom right-hand corner of the page that has a link in there about give us your testimonial. I'd love to hear it. And for those of you that want to give me a verbal testimonial that is on the phone, I really would like to ask you to call a number and leave a message for me, because I'd like to know what you think and what you would like to see talked about next time, and what you liked about the call, what you would like to see differently in another call. And that number, if you have a pencil and paper right now, it's 1-877-211-0212. That number again is 877-211-0212. I need to hear from you. I want to know what you think and share with me, you know, your comments and how you would want to, maybe whether you find this would be useful for other friends or other people that have children on the spectrum. We'd love to hear from you. And when you get to that number, just press number 1. That gets you in. You can leave a voicemail for me. I'd really love to hear it. So once again, everyone, I want to say thank you. Thanks for attending.